listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
That's right, you're on with Answers for the Family. I'm Alan Cardoza. Today we have a very interesting subject matter, and that is we're in the month of the 10-year anniversary of the Columbine shooting. And that said, we are going to talk about school violence. School violence over the last 10 years may have increased, it may have not. We're going to talk to not only some of our people here in studio, but we are going to talk to an author who has put together a book that includes a 22-page report card on how we have done as a society, how our government has done, how well they've funded it, just about everything you can think of. I mean, I couldn't imagine. When I was reading 22 pages of this, it just absolutely blew me away. So to start off with, in studio, I have Will Jones. And Will is a writer and a satirist hailing from Asheville, North Carolina. Will, glad to have you here.
Thank you, Alan. Glad to be here.
All right. And we have Dave Munoz. Dave is a lead transport agent for West Shield Adolescent Services, and he works with a lot of the kids in transporting them out of the schools. He gets to talk to them kind of at the ground level because they really bond with him. They talk to him, and they sometimes confide in him the things that they don't tell us as parents. Dave, glad to have you.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
All right. Okay, let's start off with... Let's go back 10 years, okay? Before Columbine, okay? What did we think was going on out there? I mean, did we think that we were having these kind of problems?
Well, during that time, I mean, it's coming at it from the level of someone who was a student at the time. I mean, when Columbine was around, I was 14, 15 years old. There was, at least among the area that I grew up in with the students I was around, no real consciousness of this. School violence simply wasn't a term that you heard. It wasn't something that you were really concerned about. You could liken it to the word terrorism pre-9/11. It was something that was around, but you never really heard it day in and day out like you did afterwards. It was sort of this... this term that was thought about briefly, but it wasn't part of our daily discourse. And then Columbine hits, and all of a sudden it blossomed immensely. So it was really kind of a 0 to 60 sort of event.
Right. Now you're going to school in Asheville, North Carolina,
yes,
at that time?
Yes, I was. I was in high school in Asheville.
All right. Give us the smaller town version of how that affected your school at that time.
It was really odd because I feel like then and now the schools that I were in, the schools I was in, kind of more paid lip service to the whole thing than anything else. It was a mixed but predominantly affluent kind of school district. We had, you know, I think we went from one security guard to two security guards after that. It was really, I feel like everybody did basically the minimum necessary to say to the community's parents, look, we've, you know, doubled our spending on school security.
Right.
How it affected, Asheville was in many ways, I feel like, removed from the whole thing. It may have been different in other school districts that I wasn't privy
right
to.
Now, Dave, where were you at that time?
I was actually in middle school.
Okay.
At that time.
You were in middle school in what area geographically?
Orange County.
Okay.
And from where we went from like in a kind of white dominant area, there wasn't really much change for the middle school either. I mean, security was pretty much very light until when that happened. And like he said, you know, it doubled to two security guards. But not much change. There was more on the for kids getting in fights, but no more than that violence and that, you know, there's a slap on the wrist.
Okay. Now, how do you compare that to now? It's 10 years later. You're now in a position to where you're working with kids that you're picking up from these schools. How has it changed, and what are the kids telling you that maybe we as parents or professionals out there aren't hearing?
A lot of the kids talk to me as in they relate easily to me because I'm around, you know, as a young adult, so they feel like they could relate to me other than parents. They tell me that it's very easy to get in weapons, very easy to smuggle in drugs in that case. Growing up, knowing, you know, I played football from high school and going to different colleges, the lot of security that I found at my high school were old you know, school members that graduated a year or two ago and still are friends with those kids. And, you know, a lot of them will kind of turn a blind eye to them, bringing in weapons, bringing in drugs, and, you know, after school, they'll go party with them, go hang out with them. So I always wonder, you know, what's the background check on these security guards? A lot of security guards will be a year older than, you know, these 17-year-olds that are going to the school. And so I see a lot of just friends as security guards. And, you know, our school, they lower the, you know, it doesn't cost as much to buy a professional security guard staff. Instead of, like, we'll pick up these old alumni and put them in there.
Okay, so what you're saying is that it really hasn't changed that much.
No.
You know, because I know that, I mean, I'm looking at this report card, and, you know, they're saying that, you know, we've spent an additional $10 billion. Well, if we've spent $10 billion, I think adding a couple of, you know, minimum wage security guards may not be making a big difference.
Well, in this situation, as in many, I don't really think that the trouble is how much money we're spending. It's the direction that we're throwing it.
Absolutely.
I mean, when you get down to it, the main responses that we've had to this have been a cry for gun control legislation, weapon control, and then greater security systems, metal detectors, security guards, and whatnot in the schools. So we're attacking the means and the opportunity to perpetuate school violence, but have really not thrown nearly as much time and money at attacking the motive side of it.
Absolutely. I could not agree more. And being in a business where we're working with the at-risk youth, we're working with the ones that are not going to school, or the ones that are, you know, getting involved in situations that are causing them to need to be taken to a specialized program, either for a psychological reason or for, you know, having broken some laws that puts them in that position. So, yeah, I couldn't agree more that if we can spend the money on preventative measures, you know, in other words, you're never going to be able to put them in a position where they can't get access to some form of weapon, you know. So to make it more difficult, well, maybe it's going to help a little bit, but, I mean, it's not going to have the same effect if you change the thinking, change the way in which they're approaching school and the way in which they're thinking about how they're going to treat their fellow student.
It occurs to me that the security guards and such, in a way, may be doing more harm than good, simply because, as we were just saying a minute ago, it's easier to sneak weapons and things into. The fact that is even a part of our consciousness about the thing baffles me. You know, if a student sees security guards, sees metal detectors, trying to prevent them from bringing weapons into the schools, the natural logical progression from that is, well, clearly bringing weapons to school is something that people do. You know, if there's no, I don't mean to suggest that no security is the way to go, far from it, but it reinforces the mentality that there is this kind of battle for our schools going on, which could be planting ideas for violence in the heads of people that never would have had those inclinations in another circumstance.
Mm-hmm. And Dave, what are some of the things that you're seeing? When you're going in and you're picking up a kid, again, you know, for again those that don't know, I mean, Dave is one of the lead agents. He is going in and he is picking up kids either from their home or sometimes from the school and taking them to a specialized program. Tell us what you're seeing at that level.
I see the kids. They don't care. They'll do whatever it takes to get in with whatever weapon, whatever drug is possible. They have, you know, no means to life at all. They rather take other kids' life and harm them and have no remorse for it. They'll just do whatever it takes to cause harm or chaos. I had actually pick up a couple of weeks ago, and the kid told me, you know, I love chaos. That's just one thing.
Wow.
I like causing havoc. And that's what, you know, and it was actually a female, you know, and that's another thing, you know, people don't really see that females are also a threat too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Go ahead, pull this closer a little bit. There we go. Well, let's talk about that as far as the male versus female. I mean, I think that's another change that we've had in 10 years. You know, I mean, we're now getting situations. If you look at it on an international front, as far as like the, you know, the terrorists, okay? The terrorists, everybody thought you could profile based on the fact that it's going to be a Middle Eastern male between the ages of 18 and 45 that was going to cause this. That's not the case anymore. In fact, now more and more, it is a female that they are using because they feel that they're being targeted. So now there are females that are doing this. How is that transferring over into our schools, either of you, or to here in America, and where women are now feeling empowered to, as you're saying, cause the same havoc?
I would kind of caution against the parallel between the school violence and the terrorist selection, simply because the terrorist selection that you just mentioned is an active thing. There's
right.
It's a response to the profiling. In this case, you know, there's God. I certainly hope there's no one in the schools going, all right, let's get the hands in the weapons in the hands of the girls because they won't suspect them as much.
And I'm not saying that they're saying let's get the weapons in their hands. I'm saying from the standpoint of looking at something and thinking, as Dave just said, I love havoc. You know, I saying that, you know, this is something that is somehow internally motivating me, or that I would even think of it. So yeah, you're right. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, that there's somebody that's going, now we're going to use the girls to do this, but still, just the fact that they would look at it and think, yeah, I could do that and get some attention.
Well, you know, statistically speaking, most violent criminals are male. That being said, when you get down to it, people are people. A violent person that can come from anywhere, can come from any socioeconomic background, gender, race, creed. It's simply trying to profile these things based on that is just one technique of many that's setting ourselves up for failure. It would make sense at some level to say, all right, we're going to watch the guys closer than the girls simply based on history and psychology, but really we're not trying to get 90% of these. We're not trying to catch 90% of kids that are going to cause school violence. We're trying to catch them all.
Absolutely.
We're trying to prevent them all. Even one slipping through can cause, as we've seen, a decade of introspection and in some ways hysteria.
Oh yeah. And you have then the copycat thing, because soon after something like that happens in this day and age, as soon as they get that much publicity, now you've planted the seed in out there for the other kids. Wait a minute. These guys were on television. These guys got a lot of publicity. I feel that way too. I feel bullied. I feel, like people aren't noticing me. And it's one of the things, I mean, it goes back to the beginning of time, is when you cause violence, you are immediately noticed. I mean, at that point in time, you are now doing something in which people have to do something. They have to take heed. They have to listen to you. They have to do something when there's a violent act.
Well, and if you really want to look at it this way, it's a bit of a tongue-in-cheek or even a callous way to think of it, but you could think of school violence as a sort of a fad, like getting your nose pierced or listening to the Jonas Brothers or anything like that. It's something that becomes chic, and people want to do it because it gets attention, because it's cool. And there's at least a little bit of validity to the idea that by attacking the endurance of the fad, we can actually decrease and making it socially not portraying it as evil, which it certainly is, but portraying it simply as uncool.
Absolutely.
We can actually decrease that.
Yeah. In fact, and you know what? I think we have our guest calling in right now. I'm going to answer that, but I want to touch on that because I think that works towards drugs as well. I think your point is very well taken. Hi, this is Alan Cardoza, and you're on with Answers for the Family.
Hi, this is Rick Phillips. I'm calling in.
Hey, Rick.
Interview.
How are you?
Hey. Today I'm doing fine. How about you?
We're doing great. You are on the air, and it is very good to have you. We've already sort of started the conversation, so we're talking a little bit about school violence. I have with us right now, I have Dave Munoz, who is a lead transport agent for West Shield Adolescent Services, and he does crisis intervention and adolescent transport of teenagers in crisis. So he is picking up kids from the schools and working with them and taking them to specialized programs. And I also have Will Jones, who is a writer and a satirist from Asheville, North Carolina. And we are chatting a little bit about the subject that you have apparently gathered a lot more information than probably anybody has. So welcome to the show.
Glad to be a part of the conversation. It's an important topic.
All right. Well, let me tell the listeners out there right now. Okay, Rick is a nationally recognized educator, speaker, facilitator, and trainer. He is also the lead author of the book Safe School Ambassadors. They also have a program that they do, also called Safe School Ambassadors, where they have been able to create Safe School Ambassadors and the program that helps prevent and stop bullying and violence in over 600 schools and 26 states. So first, Rick, I want to thank you for doing that because it is obviously something that's well needed.
I'm glad to be a part of the conversation. Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's start with, tell us a little bit about your group, which is Community Matters. If you could share with the audience a little bit about what Community Matters is doing and what made you decide to do such a comprehensive piece on school violence.
Gladly. Community Matters is a California, Northern California-based nonprofit. We've been around since 1996, and our mission is to engage, empower, and equip young people to be peacemakers and change agents in their schools and neighborhoods. So our entire focus is how to wake up the courage of young people to begin speaking up to make a world around them a safer place for everyone. So that drives us, and so we spent the last 10 years since the tragic days of Columbine working in schools all over the United States and Canada. And it is because of the 10-year anniversary that we wanted to take a look back and say, how much safer are our schools today, so that we could determine and make some recommendations for recognizing what's been working, but also recognizing what's not working, and talk about changing some of the strategies and approaches so we have greater success and fewer kids hurting each other.
Well, that said, tell us a little bit about what you found, and I had a chance to go over it a little bit. But I think one of the things that I was disappointed in was obviously the fact that from a grading standpoint, we haven't done that well. But let's start with federal funding. Where did we go wrong with federal funding?
Well, where we went wrong with federal funding is right after Columbine in 1999, the government was very much on this issue. Because of the scope and the magnitude of the shootings, the United States funded and created safe and drug-free schools funding to drive prevention. What has happened is that over the last 6 years, that funding has been steadily and significantly cut, so that schools have been receiving each year of the last 5 or 6 years a smaller amount of dollars to do something that's actually a growing problem. And let's be clear so your listeners understand this, that while we've seen a flattening or leveling off of homicides at schools, we have seen in the last 8 years a increase in bullying every significant year. Every year, a significant increase in bullying. So funding's been cut, and that's the primary problem, is we need to restore those dollars to schools. Secondarily, the funding that was spent has been disproportionately focused on security equipment and personnel. And there's a limit to what security cameras and metal detectors can do at schools. They can keep the bad guys out, but they can't keep the students out. And students bring weapons that get past metal detectors, and those are the weapons of prejudice and racism and gang issues and grudges from the neighborhood that all get activated in that place called the public school. So we've got to redirect some of the funding less on the security perimeters and more on changing the relationships inside the buildings.
Well, and that's a great point, and we were just talking about that from the standpoint, if we can work on changing the attitude, if we can work on making sure that we are teaching them that it is not cool and it is not the way to go, if we can spend more that way and less on, okay, we're just going to start making this more and more like a prison, I would think that we're going to have much better, much better success. But the main thing, what would you recommend?
Well, I recommend very much what your two other guests are talking about, and you've been talking about that. The problem is in the climate of the school and the attitudes that prevail in the school. One is we see an increase in kids being passive, meaning kids being bystanders. And when you have the majority of the students in the school who witness teasing and malicious comments and pushing and shoving and all the different ways that kids can hurt each other, including electronically with the increase of cyber aggression, students have to begin speaking up because they're in the best position to know about it before an adult ever knows about it. They're in the best position to intervene. But we haven't attended to helping young people gain the competency and confidence to know what to do when they see their friends saying or doing things that could lead to real trouble.
Mm-hmm. You were saying it, I was reading, this is David, about 50% increase from, you're saying, cyberbullying from 2000 to 2005. Internet's pretty new, so as in MySpaces came out in 2002 and Facebook in 2004, where does that 50% come from? I mean, from when internet started, or how do you say the cyberbullying started?
Well, students are reporting an increase in the level and frequency of the times they're seeing their names or pictures or comments made on a social network site through text messaging, through the places that you just mentioned. So there's been an increase in students' ability to understand how to use those social network sites to spread rumors and gossip and compromising photographs of people, which has increased the level of anxiety among a lot of young people because they don't know how to sort of fight back or know how to defend themselves from that.
Mm-hmm. Well, now
that's what's driving a lot of this.
Okay, well, and going back to the funding for a moment, I know that there was a, I think at one point it mentioned $10 billion. One of my thoughts was is that it kind of sounds like we've sort of stayed at somewhat of a status quo. If the $10 billion hadn't been interjected into the system, do you think that it would have gotten considerably worse just based on where we've headed as a society the last 10 years?
I think common sense would say yes to that answer, that we have a media that disproportionately focuses on violence. We have reality shows that reward people for being mean-spirited and cutthroat and behind people's backs. We have a code mm-hmm. of silence that media music messages sends to kids. I mean, we have a culture that promotes a lot of what we're seeing acted out in kids. So this $10 billion in 10 years has been primarily spent on two parts of the problem. One is preventing ingress, meaning people getting into the building who have an intention to do harm. And we spent a lot of money on the crisis response plans so that if something happens, we know how to respond. So we've kind of bookended the problem with our resources, and we can't keep spending money on that when we don't have as much money. We now got to do what you said, which is work on the attitudes of parents, teachers, and students, because it's parents, teachers, and students who are in the best position to begin to change the climate and the attitudes and the culture that condones bullying by being so passive.
Rick, Will Jones here. I wanted to ask you to elaborate on something that you just said when you were talking about students being bystanders and kind of enabling them and educating them to take care of the problem on their level. And then you just mentioned parents and teachers as well. I was surprised to hear that the first one of those out of your mouth was students rather than the parents. Most of the kind of correctional attitudes I've heard target the parents first to get kids on an even younger level. How did you arrive at the conclusion that the students was really the primary place to attack the problem?
That's a great question. The reason that we recognize the value of students is one because they're on the scene. It's their world where a lot of this bullying stuff happens, and we have to understand that oftentimes young people don't tell the truth when they come home about what's going on at school. By that I mean not telling the truth is that parents ask their children, how was your school day? And often what kids will say is fine, even when it isn't fine, because young people are reluctant to share the embarrassment of if they were a victim or a target of mistreatment. So parents, there's a whole set of things that parents can do to improve their capacity to keep their own kids safe and alive, as well as help all children. But our figuring was students see, hear, and know things that parents and teachers don't know. Students are on the scene of an incident or know about it before an adult knows about it. So students are our best detectors and our best security force, but they're not trained. They're not involved. They're not invited to perceive themselves as leaders who could affect social change. So we felt, since you don't have to pay students and you have to pay security personnel, start with the kids, because they are on the scene and the most available resource for us who could change the world. And we've spent the last 10 years working with young people and have seen the value of giving young people the opportunity and the tools to make a difference. They don't want violence in their schools. They don't want their friends or siblings to get hurt. What has kept them from speaking up is the lack of trust in adults and the lack of training and opportunities. And when we do those things, young people will be our fastest, not our only, but our quickest and fastest solution to changing the culture and climate that encourages bullying and violence to happen.
Okay. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And in fact, that makes me think of programs like Peer Court. I mean, I think Peer Court has been an incredible success that's been brought into our high schools. But yet there are times in which we will go into a high school and I speak at some of them and I will find out that they either don't have a peer court in that particular high school, or the one that they have has sort of petered out. I mean, it's lost its energy. It got pumped up at one point in time, but for whatever reason, it's sort of fading away. And I think those are the things that need to be propped up. And if it takes funding, then give them funding to be able to show them and empower them to take part of that control.
Yeah, I think it's not a one-size-fits-all. Peer court, peer helping, conflict resolution, safe school ambassadors, mentoring programs. There are so many good ideas that are out there, but what's happened is the schools are so focused on No Child Left Behind and the testing requirements to secure funding to sustain themselves that they have reduced their attention to what we might call the more social-emotional learning that is every bit as important as math, reading, and science, is to learn how to get along with people who are different, how to resolve conflicts peacefully, how to handle your emotions and your anger without turning to violence. Those are things that can be learned. So these programs, like Peer Court and others, need to not be add-ons. They need to become part of the curriculum, because they are needed. And that's one of the things we measured in this report card, was how well are prevention programs being implemented and sustained in the schools. And the best we could give was a grade of a C, because they're often personality driven. You know, somebody gets excited about a particular program, and as long as they're at the school, but if they leave because it wasn't integrated into the curriculum, the program dies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, yeah, I was just looking at that, and I noticed that, yeah, under prevention programs and curriculum, it gets a C. But that's actually one of the better grades that any one category got. What would you recommend?
That's right.
What would you recommend they do in that particular category that would raise the grade? I mean, in other words, if this is a student, okay, and you're sitting down and you're counseling with that student saying, here's what you need to do to raise your grade from a C to a B, what do you tell them to do?
Exactly, and that's exactly why we put recommendations into this report card. So it wasn't intended to be a criticism. It was intended to point at the truth and then say, how can we improve or raise the grade? So one of the things, knowing that there are good programs, and you've just described one, the Peer Court program, there are dozens and dozens of good programs out there, is that the schools can't treat them as secondarily in importance. They have to integrate them and fund them and give them the same value as a math, reading, or science class. And I understand there will be some listeners who will say, well, no, those are things that should be taught at home. The truth of the matter is home today is not the same place it once was. The pressures on parents, working families, single-parent families, the mortgage crisis, all of the issues that are making it harder for families to do the job of raising their kids alone have to be recognized that schools are our best place to do instruction. So we've got to make sure that the good programs have the funding and the support and restore some of the instructional hours that used to be available for these kinds of programs, but because of No Child Left Behind, they've been kind of kicked to the back burner. That's what we have to do to raise the grade. Make good prevention programs and intervention programs part of the curriculum and fund them and give them the same value as reading, math, and science.
Exactly. And what I hear you saying is that, and the parents can be involved in this, they can be tied into it, but we can't leave it to them to where it is solely their responsibility.
No, that whether we like it or not, we're raising our children as a community. Of course, parents and families are the primary raisers of children, but when they spend 7 or 8 hours a day in a school and then a few hours often in an after-school program of one kind or another, kids are spending the majority of their waking up time away from their families. And those places need to be places where kids are gaining the values and the competency and the encouragement to know how to resolve problems without turning to violence, how to get along with each other, how to stand up for each other. When we do that, we will see a significant reduction in these problems, because the best solution is to nip it before it escalates to something where somebody's so full of hatred that they want to come back and get even with somebody. We've also lost 2 11-year-old children in the last 3 weeks in this country to suicide because of bullying incidents in their lives. And I found myself in tears this morning reading the stories of these 2 young children. I can't fathom an 11-year-old having the kind of mind that could construct an idea that the way to solve a problem would be to take their life. It just seems so out of whack with reality, and yet it is reality, and that's why we have to be courageous enough to stand up and start looking at what we're doing and change the things that aren't working.
Absolutely. David?
Like what you were saying about the parents not really knowing what's going on. A lot of my transports, you know, I talk to the parents before the transport, and they'll give me so much information because they don't know a lot. And during the transports afterwards, I talked to the parents, and they had no clue, you know, 90% of the stuff that their kid was doing. You know, a parent thought that the kid was only smoking weed. Comes to realize that the kid was a dealer. You know, he was also on every drug known to man, and, you know, just had all this, and the parents had no clue. And, you know, when a kid kills himself and the parents are shocked, the parents are not always involved. A lot of the kids go, you know, I don't talk to my parents. I don't. You know, I don't associate with them. You know, my dad's somewhere else. And it's real sad to see that the parents can't, you know, communicate with their kids and not know what they're doing on a day-to-day basis.
That's true.
Now, the one thing that I wanted to point out just on the that statistic you just quoted, Rick, about the 2 11-year-olds, these are not isolated cases. It's not like 2 11-year-olds in the last 3 weeks and then there's been really nothing else. There's for every one of those cases, there are innumerable children that we never talk to, that never get any kind of help, that never get any kind of recognition, who are very much being pushed to the brink. It is one of those things where the vast, vast, overwhelming majority of those statistics never see the light of day, simply because they typically never reach any adult ears, if any ears at all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in the case of these 2 young boys, one in Georgia and one in Massachusetts, the parent reports often going to the school and saying, you know, my child's being called names and humiliated. Please help me. And the school is sometimes saying, but we don't have any evidence of this happening. We only have your son's comment and your concern until we have hard evidence. And it just points out again the sort of the ineptness, and I want to say ineptness not in terms of concern, but that adults miss so much of what's going on, and that's why I think it's important that we turn towards the young people themselves, because I think they're in the best position, because often the students know, you know, who's doing what. The students know who's harassing whom. They know what's going on. They know who's thinking about sending something out on the internet the night before it gets to everybody through the technology available. And we have to begin to really call upon our kids to find the courage and character to speak up. But they won't speak up if we don't empower them and equip them and recognize them as leaders. If we keep seeing them as the problem or the consumer of programs rather than the solutions and contributors, we'll not have a significant change in things in 5 or 10 years from now.
Would you say that the presence and prevalence of the security guards, cameras, metal detectors reinforces that idea that the children are the problem and not the solution?
Yeah, I think it's a complex issue, but there many kids report feeling uncomfortable with the kind of airport-like feeling that some schools have. And I think for some adults, that security can provide what I would call a false sense of security.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a 13-year-old boy in Cleveland last school year that walked past 26 video cameras with a gun and killed two students before turning the gun on himself. And so we don't want to depend exclusively on equipment. You know, the best security is a caring school, a community where kids and staff are on the lookout for each other. And when we emphasize that, when we teach that, when we fund that, we'll fix the problem from the inside out as opposed to trying to keep the problem from coming from the outside in.
Well, and I couldn't agree more. And I noticed that under the category of youth involvement, unfortunately, we've gotten a D on that also. And I'd like to ask you if there would be a correlation in the way in which we've evolved by the way that we've handled drugs in the school. And that is that, you know, if I go back 30 years ago and when I was investigating those things, the concept at that time was, just catch them. In other words, all you're going to worry about is catch people. And I actually had a meeting with the sheriff's department one time and said, I have this idea. Why don't we, instead of trying to place undercover operatives in the schools and make them look really cool and everything to figure out who's doing the drugs or who's selling the drugs, I said, what you're doing is you're placing somebody in there that's cool, and you're giving them a nice car and money and nice clothes, and they're the drug dealer. And instead of it being something that motivates kids not to do drugs, it's motivating them to do drugs because you're more concerned with trying to catch whoever the dealer is that's bringing it in. I said, what if we do this in the opposite? And that is, you place, and at the time, I was 19 and working undercover, why don't you place me and people like me in, give us the nice car, the clothes, the money, and we will be the anti-drug people, and we'll make a mockery of anybody that's selling drugs so that people will go, if I want to be cool, I want to be like them. And I sat at a table with about 7 people representing law enforcement from different cities that looked at me like I was from another planet and said, I don't get it. Who do we arrest? And at that point, it hit me. They don't get it. It isn't about who do we arrest. You know, if they approach it their way, we will always need to have huge law enforcement agencies protecting us. If we approach it from the standpoint of they're impressionable, they want to have kids that they look up to or young people that they look up to, give them something else. So, but, you know, and we now know that that is what has started to take place, because now we have over television, we have celebrities that are going on saying, just say no to drugs. Or, and I remember that when they came out with the, here's your brain, you know, and then they have scrambled eggs, you know, here's your brain on drugs, you know, to try to get them to look at things a little differently and believe that it isn't cool, you know, that their heroes aren't doing them. In fact, their heroes are telling them not to. You know, I think if we can do the same thing in regards to the violence issue, I think we're going to make a better dent in it anyway.
I think you're talking about social change. You know, we're talking about social change, norm change, values change, and of course, all these things take time. And I think that's what really, in the long term, we can have more success if we do and incorporate some of your suggestions and many of the recommendations that we've included in this report card. Because it's been 10 years since we started this process from Columbine forward, and if we're not inaccurate, this report card really says we've got to change course and we've got to reallocate our resources and priorities in some different directions. We've had some success. We've seen a flattening of homicides on school, but we're not seeing a change in bullying and mistreatment. So we just want to redirect ourselves towards where the problem lies, and that's in the building with attitudes, doing programs, getting teachers to build better relationships with kids, be hall friendly, get to know the names of the boys and girls in your building, because it's relationships that build trust, and when there's more trust in the building, students are more likely to bring information forward, more likely to feel powerful instead of powerless. And so these are all slow changes, but we can do them if we keep promoting and getting to our school boards and to our legislators and use this. I hope people will use this report card, and they can download it, if I may offer, just at our website.
Please, please do. I was just going to bring that up. So, yeah, please give them where they can go to download the report card.
Yeah, the report card is at www.community-matters.org. community-matters.org. And there's a place to download or register to download for the report card in it. As you know, as a parent or a concerned citizen, take it to a school board member, take it to a principal. Say, I would invite you to review this. It has some interesting material, research, and findings in here that might inform a conversation we need to have. We can sit down together, police and parents and staff and students and churches, and we can sit down together and say, this isn't a school problem. It's a community problem. It's a public health problem. And we all have to work together to make it better and improve it, rather than pointing fingers at any one, you know, sector of the community. Well, we wanted our report card to be a catalyst for that conversation.
Well, and exactly. And for those listening, now Rick also has, as a book out, Safe School Ambassadors. Tell us first where they can get that book, and who do you feel it's directed to most?
Thank you. The book is available at Amazon. It's also available at Josie Bass, which is the publisher of the company, Josseybass, or Amazon. And the book we wrote, it took 3 years to write. We produced it a year ago or published it primarily for educators, parents, school board members, counselors, teachers, who work in the buildings or work in after-school programs, youth-serving organizations, to look at how we can, again, how do you, if people believe it is important to involve the students because of the unique position they're in, how do you do it? How do you do it effectively? How do you do it successfully? You just can't wish it. You can't mandate it. You can't encourage it. But what can you do? So we wanted to put strategies that were effective, and we've been working with over the last 10 years, into the book. So it's a very friendly book about how to go back to a public school and get the kids to be a stronger voice for keeping a school safe.
All right. Now, and I know that we have some special ed liaisons that listen, because they've emailed me and made comments. How would they get to their administrators the information that they would like to have a program set up like this in their school?
I think by just visiting our website. Again,
okay.
There's
same
so
website.
Much downloadable material and video clips and other tools that might help to inform somebody as to how to go to an administrator and say, or a PTA or somebody else, and say, here's an idea I'm learning about. I think it's worth us exploring. We're anxious to help people. Or people can contact us directly through the website and through our phone numbers, and we'll get materials to them if they want to use the report card or the book in a way that would help them get the conversation going. I think people want solutions, and they want things that work. And I think that's what we've attempted to do, is to stir the conversation both in our book and this report card to what are we doing well, what are we not doing well, what do we need to do better, and how do we do it better so we have better results.
All right. Well, for some of our educators that are listening out there, I noticed that under staff involvement, they've gotten a C. So what did you find that got them that C, and then what would you recommend, again, to be able to bring that grade up?
I think we gave them a passing grade because we know that most adults who work at schools and out of schools, like your guest today, all care deeply about kids, care deeply about young people, and want their lives to be rich and safe and productive. So certainly, you know, that's something we know that's so. And we know that there are a lot of people who commit a lot of time at school beyond just their contract to work with kids. What we do know is the reason we couldn't give a better grade than a C, a passing grade, is that the school's mandates are so much on academics that it discourages teachers from spending time building relationships with kids. Because there's such pressure to teach to test, that teachers have fewer hours, fewer minutes available for just building the kind of connectedness which brings kids to school. There's been less time for them to focus on that, less focused time on curriculum that supports relationships. So one of the things we recommend if we were to look for improving that grade would be more teacher training and staff training on how to identify the more complex, pervasive ways kids are bullying, how to build relationships with kids so students are more likely to bring information forward. You know, there's been this enormous bystander study by the Secret Service that said so many kids knew about shootings but didn't bring the information forward, and when they went back and interviewed the bystanders who had information and said, why didn't you speak? And they said because they didn't trust the adults would keep their name out of it, or they didn't trust the adults would really even believe or take them seriously. So trust is stimulated by relationships and connectedness, and so there has to be more staff time and more staff and school commitment to seeing the value of building relationships and not just teaching curriculum.
All right. Now, we also noticed that there is a category for school community partnership, which got a D+. What can we do as parents, you know, and as part of the community to partner with the school to get them to raise that grade or to help them, help us all raise the grade?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way of saying it, to help them all of us to help raise the grade. Well, I think it's two ways. I think oftentimes schools are not as friendly, so to speak, to outside help, even when it's available. Often schools feel beleaguered and overwhelmed by what they've got to do already, so inviting a youth serving organization or a task force or parent volunteers into the school sometimes feels like more work than it's worth. So on one hand, schools have to recognize that it's not their problem to fix, it's the community's problem to address, and they have to be more open and receptive to working with, you know, city government and parent volunteers and youth-serving organizations that your guests represent who are doing things to help kids. And secondarily, parents and youth-serving organizations have to be more assertive to go to the school and say, look, we recognize that you can't do this alone. We recognize that these kids belong to all of us. How can we help you? What support can we give you? Can we volunteer? Can we provide resources? How can we work together? So I think schools have to be more assertive in welcoming community support and asking for it, and community volunteers and parents and youth have to be more assertive to go to the school and say, we want to help. We want to reduce the likelihood of any of our children being bullied or mistreated or ultimately hurt.
Rick, a couple of times here in the last couple of minutes, we've heard you say things about schools being beleaguered and teachers and faculty being simply too busy to build relationships with students. Have we seen a correlation in this increase in bullying that we're talking about over the last few years with an increase in class sizes and a decrease of the number of faculty members per students? Is there a correlation there?
There seems to be that correlation, that as we've taken our eye off the prize of recognizing smaller schools, smaller ratios between youth and adults, more, you know, relationships, and we focus more on bigger schools, more academic, more minutes on curriculum, there is a correlation. And that, coupled with the fact that kids know how to hurt each other, you know, in different ways. Many adults will hear the talk about bullying, and they'll say, oh, it wasn't so bad when I was growing up. You know, a couple of big kids took my lunch money a couple of times. But today, bullying is much more complex, much more subtle. You know, it's girl-on-girl relational aggression. It's kids with a glance or a sign letting somebody know that they're in trouble or someone's going to get them. So it's more complex. And so there is a correlation that if we don't focus on connectedness and relationship, we should expect there'll be more incidents of mistreatment because our lack of involvement is, in a sense, giving permission for that to happen.
You know what, Rick? Time has absolutely flown by. We've got about 30 seconds. I've got one quick question, and then if we can close, and that is, overall, do you think as a nation we failed to make good on our promises made to our children in the wake of the Columbine tragedy?
I think we've fallen short on the promise we made that we would ensure that they were safe. And I think unless we're willing to admit it and recognize that nobody did it intentionally, we will continue to have the kind of shocking stories about kids hurting themselves and each other. And so this is a call to action, as we're doing on your program today. Speaking about it can begin change. We need to change. We need to do better.
Rick, thank you so much. We are out of time. I appreciate you coming on. And again, if you can give the website, if anybody has additional questions, you can either go to our website and we'll pass the questions on, which is answersforthefamily.com. That's answers, the numeral for thefamily.com. Or, Rick?
www.community-matters.org.
All right, Rick. Thanks. Keep up the good work. And I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Appreciate being a part of this panel. Thanks for the opportunity to share it with you.
All right. Take care. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right. That does it for us. Dave Munoz, thank you for being here. Will Jones, thank you. Guys, let's do this again. We've had a great time, and we are out of here.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.